Session number 9772.
Colonel Owen, Reel 3, you were just saying that you were pursued by the Germans.
Yes. Well, we sort of. I was basically with 16th Division with General Lekic. Ted Howe was sometimes with the 16th, but also sometimes with the sort of what they call the Third Corps headquarters. That was a certain General Costa Nudge, who was, one of the very much the higher commanders of the partisans out there. And we sort of acted as the liaison with these two or three units. And our paths crossed and then went away. We'd meet up, and then perhaps 2 weeks later we'd see each other again, and so on. And we were spending our time getting in supplies for the partisans whenever we could. They were very short of everything, really, and particularly they were particularly short of food. I mean, they were physically they were in a pretty terrible state. I mean, up and down these mountains, sort of, they'd been up and down the mountains in the winter and so on. They would never ask for food. I mean, we used to ask for food to be sent in, but their attitude was that if they asked for food, we would think that they weren't really serious, if you might put it that way, that they could ask for arms and ammunition, but food was a luxury which was really not to be asked for.
Weren't they being supplied by food from the local population?
Oh, in Bosnia, there is no local population. I mean, it's very Bosnian mountains, tiny little villages, right up in the mountains. In fact, Bosnia was basically not particularly pro-partisan. It was more pro-Mihailovic. And I mean, I can't remember just what strength, but I would have thought sort of the 16th, this little outfit I was with, the 16th Division, I just thought it must have been about 3,000 people. And you get 3,000 people moving about in a group in the hills and the mountains. Food, I mean, local food doesn't exist. I mean, they're that quantities. Well, you get some. I mean, food they got, they captured food. At times their operations were based on the necessity to capture food, capture arms, and they had, of course, all this problem of wounded. I mean, it's a terrible problem, the wounded, what to do with them, and so on. I mean, it was a curious life. It was a life that went from day to day. We might be in one place for 2 days, or we might be on the move for 2 or 3 days. On several occasions, there were big efforts by the Germans to surround us. I mean, with several divisions, mountain divisions, out to try and get us. And so, I mean, they existed by moving very rapidly from one area to another and breaking through the cordon that, the Germans would throw around you. I mean, the Germans were being assisted, I think without any shadow of doubt, by the Chetniks, the Mihailovic people. Of course, when I was in there, I mean, there was this invidious situation that there was me as a little individual with a partisan group, and of course, not all that far away, there were Mihailovich groups, also with a British officer.
Did you know the names of the British officers with the Chetniks?
I honestly can't remember whether I did or whether I didn't. Can't remember particularly. Actually, it was not all that long after I went in, I suppose, that we withdrew our support from Mihailovich. But as you may know, for quite some time we were supplying both sides.
Would the partisans say to you, look here, you know, you're supporting our enemies, the Chetniks?
They knew quite well that we were supporting both sides. They looked upon it as something which we were just misguided, which I think we were.
But they didn't complain to you about it?
No. Oh, no. They looked upon the Chetniks or so on, Mihailovich supporters, as being misguided. They treated them, when they caught them, when they captured them, they treated them pretty leniently, if I may put it in that point of view. I mean, usually they just disarmed them and sent them off and said, for God's sake, go back to your farms or your something. Because, of course, on the other side, vis-à-vis the Germans and the Ustashi and so on, the Croats, I mean, there were no prisoners. I mean, you know, that you didn't take prisoners. Or if you had prisoners, you shot them. I mean, there was no method by which prisoners could be looked after. The best of my belief, insofar as we took prisoners, they may have been shot, but they were not maltreated.
Did that apply to German prisoners as well?
Yeah, yeah. But on the other side, I mean, certainly the, as far as I could understand, anyone who was taken prisoner by the Germans, or even worse, by the Croat troops or the German-officered Croats or Ustashi, I mean, were normally tortured, very badly tortured, before they were eventually killed. There was no quarter on either side, but though I didn't physically see any, you know, one being tortured, obviously, or anything like that, certainly this was what was believed, and from all the stories that came from people who, from the local villagers and everything else, was that anyone who was caught by the other side, you know, had a pretty poor end.
Would they display bodies or leave bodies lying about?
Well, there were bodies lying about, but I mean, I never saw any sort of ones one would said, you know, could say one was tortured or something.
But you saw bodies of dead partisans?
Oh, yes.
That who'd been in captivity?
Well, no, I couldn't say that I ever saw that those that had actually been in captivity. I saw more dead that, you know, something had happened to them, you know, in the engagements that took place. But to what extent it happened, I don't know. I never actually saw them shoot any, but certainly it was said that rather than let their own wounded fall into enemy hands, it was better to shoot them. I mean, we had a lot of wounded with us, and we were never actually in the position that we ever left or had to leave our wounded behind. We always somehow broke through with them. And they were, you know, dragged along in carts and on horseback and this and that. So I can't say that I ever saw it, but I would certainly believe this was so. I don't think there was any. It was a sort of fairly sort of desperate struggle.
Why did you oppose British support for the Chetniks?
I believe that they considered, or that their hierarchy considered, communism a greater threat than Germans. I think they were good patriots based on the old Yugoslav regime, who thought they were doing the right thing, and that the greatest danger to their country was communism. Support for Tito and that side was, of course, a support for the Russians and communism. I believe one was involved, saw a lot of this going on in Cairo on the political side. Of course, there was one of the great questions that's always asked as to whether we were right in removing support from Milovic and so on. And whether this wasn't all due to a sort of a plot out in Cairo to get support away from the regime there, the old regime. I was pretty junior to speak with any authority on that particular subject.
In that connection, some people mentioned James Klugman. Did you ever come across him?
Good Lord, yes. I had a high regard for James Klugman. First of all, in Cairo, when I was on their staff. James was a communist, was known to be a communist. And on the other hand, he was, to my mind, from what I saw, the most able staff officer they had on the Yugoslav section. Very knowledgeable, very able man. There'd been a lot of criticism about Klugman, been a lot of criticism about SOE as to how someone with his background got into the position that he did. What I find quite amusing is that after the war, I worked for a chap who was in on the Mihailovic side, called Kenneth Greenlees, who wrote a book called Misfire, if I remember correctly, about this very sad Mihailovic story of the British liaison officers that were involved. He was as right-wing as you could think of a person. I worked for him after the war when James Klugman was in London. And all I can say is that he used to ask old James out to lunch and used to get old James to go and lunch with him at Boodle's or something like that. And when James Klugman died, I was chairman of the Special Forces Club at that time. And the person I immediately went to write an obituary was Kenneth Greenlees, who in fact wrote James Klugman's obituary in our magazine. And I think I'm correct, my memory says that in fact Kenneth Greenlees, I believe, was in charge of the Yugoslav section when James Klugman was promoted from sergeant to lieutenant or commissioned. And it was, Kenneth Greenlees always took, full responsibility for it.
He did it in full knowledge that...
Oh, yes. But here was a chap who knew a lot about that part of the world and so on. And it was an incredible work. God knows what would have happened. To my mind, it was an extraordinarily badly run section, certainly in the later days. If there was anyone who knew the answer to one's questions, the one person who would always answer everything was James Klugman.
So it was not just his knowledge, but his hard work as well.
Oh, worked like anything, yeah. Oh, he really did. And he was personally, you know, interested in everyone and everything that went on. I mean, it was his life, this particular thing.
You talked about the social contact which Greenlee's had with him. Of course,
say Kenneth would ask him out, you know, fun, you know. Okay, he might have been, I think at that time, James was one of the four or five, was it, sort of in a cabinet of the Communist Party in this country at the time. But that didn't mean to say one didn't, you know, as an individual couldn't have respect for James Tugman.
And presumably he had a kind of public school background which enabled him to mix in that way.
Well, I don't know about that. Funnily enough, I was just glancing, because I'd forgotten about it, at a book written by Basil Davidson, where he mentions, I didn't have time to look at very much this morning, he mentions quite a bit about James Tugman. But I don't think I think his background is rather mysterious. I don't think anyone, you know, it seems to be not very well known as to what his background was.
Did you mix with him socially, Klugman?
After the war, no.
In Cairo?
Oh, socially? No, well, I mean, you know, one didn't really mix with anyone particularly socially. I mean, he was one of the people there. One came across him because he was, he was the person who would answer most of my questions if I had them in that section. One would go down and see James. But socially, no. He wasn't in a sort of little gang of friends. In fact, one didn't depart from Wigginton and the WAF, who was also in our group. Her name was, in those days, was Linda Morse. We were a little group together, and we didn't have a social life, really, much. We didn't have time for it.
Would you have political discussions with James Klugman?
No.
I interrupted your narrative, if we could go back to that, and your activities with the 16th Division.
Oh, yes. Well, this was a sort of life. I mean, it sort of went on. It's difficult to pinpoint anything particular. There were times when things were going well with us. There were times that things weren't going well. We spent our life on the move a good bit of the time. Hell of a lot of it on the move, all going along in single file at night, or, you know, one area to another. Getting supplies, arranging for drops, coding messages, sending messages. Looking back to life, which really one can't remember many specific things. One can remember odd, stupid instances of, when I say stupid, sort of, in retrospect, instances we had a case. I don't know whether, I believe someone else may have had a case of it too, because I saw this in someone's book, funnily enough, and, or written down somewhere, where one of the wretched Yugoslavs, after a drop, had found, you know, a container with plastic explosive in, which smelt rather like toffee, and, you know, it actually ate a stick of the thing, and damn nearly died after it. And it all seemed rather, it was rather sad at the time, though. In fact, it did send this particular chap that I saw, it sent him off his head. I mean, after that, he became an even more abnormal person than he was before. I mean, he lay on the floor, you know, sort of frothing, and God knows, but a stick of that chemical inside you was... But they were so hungry, you know, they'd eat anything. But there were sort of odd little incidents that came. There were odd times when... I can remember, say, the one and only time I ever took my boots off at night, we were jolly nearly put in the bag. that night, because in the middle of the night we were surrounded, and in all the dark, you know, there was absolute pandemonium and chaos, but we managed to get away. But taught one the lesson that one never took one's boots off.
Did you have to leave them behind?
No, I got my boots on. I only had one pair of boots. But life was a whole lot of little instances, bigger instances, though instances when we were caught by these blooming aircraft. You know, they had obviously directional finders on our wireless. You could always guarantee almost that if you're out somewhere in the open, there were any air of these little featureless stalks about or whatever they were. Even though we were under the trees and hid ourselves, you know, they'd find out roughly where we were and come down and sort of strafe the area. Other times, slightly more unpleasant, were the Stukas. You know, they'd bring down Stukas on you. There were people killed, and I say we moved about, and that was life. It's difficult to sort of, it's sort of all rather unreal now.
You mentioned the operations which the 16th Division conducted. Were they raids just to get supplies or to harass the Germans or what?
They were, I would say that when they attacked, they were more often in order to get supplies. But we were continually harassed as well. They were forever trying to surround us. So that we were continually on the move. It was the most wonderful thing if you had 2 days actually without, you know, marching. On, and this terribly slow. They went along in single file. And you had the horses, and you marched, and usually at night you were moving, mainly at night, because at daytime it was pretty dangerous to move in big numbers. We got caught quite often in the daytime, you know, and it was very unpleasant. But over and up and down the mountains, never seemed to stop, and you just plodded on behind the chap in front, or the horse in front, or the so on.
It sounds as though you were hanging on for grim death.
Well, it was a sort of survival, yes. It was not... There were times, really, when, for a short period, one had quite a nice little rest for a day or two, and everything seemed serene, and while everyone licked their wounds a bit, and then something would happen. We never knew. It was very difficult to get out of the partisans what their plans were. We were never really privy to their plans. They'd never say, look, we're going to, this is our plan for the next day. I suppose probably a lot of the answer was they didn't have any plans because they could never tell what was going to happen to them, what the next move was on the other side. But they were very secretive, indeed. Though personally, our relationship on an individual basis couldn't have been more friendly. They looked after us. They did everything they could to make our life as comfortable as life could be. Relations were very rarely strained. There were occasions when we would be summoned to be talked to by the commissar. Of course, there were lots of every little unit had its commissar, but our sort of divisional headquarters commissar might ask to see us, come and so on, and he'd then sort of read us a bit of a lecture about some criticism of the West, or etc. And when he'd done his stuff, he'd say, "That's fine, now I'm finished, we'll all go and have a drink." And, but he'd got his stuff to do and so on, and that was that. And there was no problem. We did have with us a very one of these, Lekic, I think had taken place in the Spanish, had taken part in the Spanish Civil War. We did have with us what we considered a sort of a mystery man who had certainly also been in the Spanish Civil War. I mean, he was a real trained, proper Moscow-trained operator man.
What was his name?
His name, he went by the name of Esau. What his real name was, I have the foggiest. They all had nicknames, But to us, he was Esau. And he was Moscow trained, he very quiet and a very intelligent fellow. If we ever had, insofar as one could say we ever had any problems with them, we only really had to go, if it was a political type problem or something, was to go to Esau and tell him our problem, and he'd get it solved. He was always in all the discussions one had with them over whatever it was, he'd usually be there, and you could guarantee 100% common sense, irrespective of the politics, as to what his view was, and no one ever really contradicted him.
What type of political problems would he sort out for you?
Oh, it's difficult to remember back. I can't honestly remember, but occasionally there were problems about something, or I don't know what. But, or even in their plans, what the sensible thing to do was, or anything. He was first class, very quiet. He was a sort of an extra. I mean, the actual division had its commissar, of course. But he was in a sort of a street of his own. He was a, one could never find out just what position they really occupied, these chaps. Because decisions were taken, both by the, Lekic, who